Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Colton Scrivener is a behavioral scientist with a PhD in comparative human development. And his line of study was the evolutionary root of why we're drawn to dark and scary stuff. In his new book, he has a chance to share what he's learned about those who are morbidly curious. That's the title of the book. It's also a term of art for the thing he's explaining. Being morbidly curious is to have that impulse to look at the car wreck or an open casket. If you really love gory video games or slasher films, you fit somewhere in the category. And Scrivener fits in there too. His interest started early.
I liked spooky things as a kid. Goosebumps and Courage the Cowardly Dog. But I think my first real experience with something that really scared me was with Resident Evil.
Bizarre murder cases have recently occurred in Raccoon City.
I was probably 5 or 6 and found a copy of it and was playing it. And this is like the original Resident Evil 1 where you're in the mansion.
Stop it! Don't open that door!
But Chris's!
There's dogs and birds that are infected and zombies and fixed third-person point of view that gave you very little control of what you could see.
What is it?
Watch out! It's a monster!
Let me take care of this.
And I remember that it was frightening, obviously, because it was made for adults. And it was also frightening because you couldn't really, like, just pause the game. You had to go to a safe space to save your game or to sort of protect yourself. You know, it's like a room with a typewriter where you can save your game and the zombies can't get in there. And I remember those being a space where I could, like, kind of collect myself and, you know, plan and strategize and calm myself down. And it served as kind of a way for me to just regroup and go back at this thing that was scary, but also was very fun. This was a way to kind of challenge me to, in particular, learn how to regulate feeling afraid and feeling anxious. And it was much later when I became a scientist and I started reading similar stories from other people and researching it that I thought, well, maybe that's similar to what was going on, you know, when I was a kid. Morbid curiosity, you know, probably came about as a way to actually protect us, you know, in situations where we needed to pay attention to danger. And as we developed written culture and now, you know, in the past 100 years, incredible forms of media for storytelling, I think we can kind of co-opt that in a way that allows us to approach dangerous situations very safely through the form of storytelling, whether that's a game or a book or a movie or a television show or even an oral story, where we can put ourselves in a situation to feel afraid and feel anxious where there's no real consequences to those feelings. And so we can kind of grapple with them in a better way than we could if we were truly in danger and feeling afraid and anxious.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Colton Scrivener's main point, then, is that morbid curiosity serves a purpose. It's not a glitch. It's an evolutionary tool, and it helps us, like, rehearse danger without actually being in it, experience fear and loss, even violence from a safe distance through movies and games and true crime. At a deeper level, it's how we cope with that biggest threat of all, the knowledge that we are going to die. So morbid curiosity isn't about loving death. It's about learning how to live with the fact of it. Aside from being a psychologist at Arizona State University, Scrivener runs a horror film festival and the Eureka Springs Zombie Crawl. It's a street party where fans shuffle through the town dressed as the undead.
The scientist part came first. You know, that was kind of my entryway into doing more horror production type stuff, or consulting on horror productions or creating my own through, you know, I have a film festival,
yeah,
a horror film festival, and as well as a Halloween parade and festival, and another sort of convention related to that coming up in 2026 in this year. And it allowed me an entry point, I think, into the more industry-facing world of horror because I was one of the few people who was studying the science of it.
Right.
And so I had this sort of unique experience and somewhat unique knowledge about horror as a genre that, you know, again, it kind of opened doors for me to do interesting things in the horror production.
But where did the science interest come from? When did that occur to you that I want to kind of figure this out, work this out? Like, there's a part of me that wonders if there's not a kind of, defensiveness on your part and on behalf of other kind of kindred spirits
sure,
out there,
sure.
You know, to, a
sure.
way to tell the world, look, people who are morbidly curious aren't sickos.
Yeah. It started out really as I was a grad student. I was in my, probably first year of grad school for my PhD. And, when you're a grad student, like any good grad student, I was curious about all sorts of things and, you know, had ideas for all sorts of projects. And it kind of just so happens the one I landed on had to do with violence and why and how humans can create situations where violence is not only morally okay, but even a form of entertainment, right? This is something that pops up throughout history and all across different cultures. And so I was interested in how people made sense of this cognitively. And I kind of started with that. And basic idea was we have this thing that is typically morally reprehensible mm-hmm. and even mm-hmm. produces fearful, you know, responses or disgust responses. And yet we have somehow co-opted this into an incredibly lucrative even form of entertainment. So I was very interested in how we made that switch. And what happens in the mind when we make that switch?
I think it's interesting that as you kind of describe it, I don't think this is just a flex, but you're a pioneer in this research, right? And I wanted to ask you about that. Like, how much data, how much research was there about this before you really started digging in? Because it seems like a lot of this information, some of your theories are quite new and some of the ideas yeah. here are fairly new. And that I think that's interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the questions are old, right? Like the base questions.
Right.
I mean, go back to like Aristotle, right?
Sure.
I certainly didn't ask anything new. It's something that people have been asking for a long time. Psychologists hadn't really been asking it much. There was some work in the 80s. So when slasher films became really popular, you know, after Halloween and kind of into the 80s, psychologists did start asking this question, but it was asked with an assumption that something was wrong.
Right.
And it showed up in their methods, right? And that's, you know, that's not great, but it's, you know, what you find is what you find. And so when I started looking at what they found, I started seeing, well, perhaps they found this because the experiments they were conducting were, you know, they had some blind spots about that. And so, for example, you know, one study that proclaimed in the 80s that proclaimed to find that liking horror movies was associated with low empathy. It's one of the few studies that had really looked at this.
Right.
When you go and look at their methods for that study, what you find is that the stimulus they used to indicate whether or not someone liked horror was very specific and probably not related to enjoying horror. It was, you know, a violent death scene in a horror movie. It was just a clip with no resolution, no story behind it, just this like 30-second clip. And they asked someone, how much do you like this? And of course, you know, people who like that might score a little higher on things like sadism or psychopathy or low empathy, but that doesn't mean that they're horror fans. They were using that as a measure of horror fandom. And so I think they were just measuring the wrong thing. So what I've tried to do is be more careful and specific about what I'm measuring. And when I do that, I don't find what, you know, those few studies had found.
Yeah, I think a lot of people sort of come to it with a sort of knee-jerk or a kind of, they think that's a common sense conclusion to say that people who are drawn to violent content are just kind of something's wrong with them. They're a little off. And early on in the book, you write about the way people reacted, the way some critics reacted to those really violent horror films like Saw. And before that, Friday the 13th, there was a New York Post critic who said that people who watched the Saw series were depraved lunatics was how they put it. And then Gene Siskel which you write about, said Friday the 13th fans were very sick people who hate women. So how do you explain that reaction?
I understand, you know, the sort of inference that, okay, if you enjoy really violent movies where there's a lot of suffering, you know, maybe you also are okay with violence in general, than more so than the average person. I understand that.
Sure.
So I think it's just people who didn't look deeply enough or ask questions deeply enough. They kind of went with their gut instinct. And in this case, that gut instinct was just, it seems to be incorrect, right?
Yeah. Well, let's define the term. Morbidly curious, it's the title of the book, and it's a kind of a term of art, something that's misunderstood. So what do you mean by what is that? What is morbidly curious? What does it mean?
Well, when we hear the adjective morbid on something, we typically associate it with bad, right? And that comes from the fact that, you know, in many cases it is associated with something bad, like comorbidities, for example. In the medical literature, it gives a hint of something that is causing death or causing, you know, ailment. And when I use the term morbidly curious, it's not the curiosity that's morbid, right? It's not in the sense that the curiosity is bad. It's that we are curious about things that are morbid, are curious about things that could cause danger, that could be bad. And so I think that's also where the mix-up gets, that happens sometimes. We think, oh, well, you know, it's my curiosity that's bad. But really, it's just that you're curious about bad things. And those are two very different situations to be in.
Okay, so we're going to get into some of the sort of the details here in a second, but let me give you a kind of general scenario, kind of a tame one. So let's say a group of friends they're together watching a football game, and someone gets hurt. I mean, bad. Like there's a bad injury, looks bad, you know, a hyperextended knee, or let's say a bone gets snapped. I mean, this stuff happens. And it seems like there are the ones in the group who turn away, can't see it, can't look at it, can't watch the replay. And there are others who are drawn to it. They want to see it over and over and over again. Can you explain what's going on there, and what does this tell us about morbid curiosity?
Yeah, you know, other traits can moderate how morbidly curious we are, right? So things that some things may make us more averse to witnessing something in particular, like being visually exposed to something that is dangerous, like a bodily injury. So, for example, if you have high disgust sensitivity, you might be a little more likely to turn away if you see a broken bone. If you have high levels of affective empathy, where you involuntarily feel another person's situation or emotions in a situation, that could cause you to look away, because empathy can be, especially affective empathy, can be sort of costly, can feel costly, right? So there are traits that would moderate that. So even the person who turns away might be morbidly curious, but maybe they have these high levels of empathy, of affective empathy, and disgust sensitivity, and maybe some other traits, personal distress or other things that cause them to not want to see it visually. Maybe they want to read about it later or hear about it later, but they don't want to look at it. But, you know, certainly in that case, what's happening is you're seeing the outcome of a situation that was kind of violent, right? It's supposed to be sort of dramatized violence, but, you know, football is very much a contact sport. And so real accidental acts of violence in the sense of like injuries do occur. And so when they do, you want to see like, okay, well, why was this so bad? And, you know, it doesn't happen. Why doesn't this happen every play? What happened differently here? How did they land so that this happened? Like you're kind of shaping your schema for how an injury occurs and what can lead to it. And I think it's much less to do with like, oh, I don't like this person, so I'm glad that they got injured, right? I mean, you'd be just as curious and maybe even more curious if it happened to the team you're rooting for than if it happened to the team you hate, right? So I think it has very little to do with Schadenfreude or anything like that, and very much has to do with an interest in these somewhat uncommon but very consequential accidents that can happen.
I think the idea of how it works in human nature, and we'll get to the evolutionary part here in a second, but like you write about how psychologists talk about us having a negativity bias. But it's not just negativity. You say in the book it's driven by threats. Talk a little bit about how we process a threat and maybe say something about the smoke detector principle, because I think this illustrates a lot.
Yeah, I mean, we can start with the smoke detector principle. You know, it's, I think, a really handy analogy for thinking about why our minds are shaped the way they are when it comes to threat. So if you have a smoke detector in your house, especially if you have one in your kitchen, you've probably had to turn it off before. You know, it's probably beeped at you and you're cooking. Maybe you overcooked something in the oven or your bacon sizzled too long on the skillet or whatever. And the smoke detector went off despite the fact that there's no fire, and maybe even despite the fact that there wasn't a lot of smoke. And that can be irritating, right? But that's actually a good situation to be in. It means that your smoke detector is very sensitive to danger, which is kind of what you want. Because even though it's a very minor cost and it's more just of an annoyance when you have to turn off, you know, get a ladder and like push the button to turn the smoke detector off when there's not a fire, doing that 1,000 times is worth it as long as that smoke detector is sure to go off when there's really a fire. And so our minds are kind of the same way when it comes to danger. It's better to be a bit sensitive to potential dangers. So if we think we see something, we think we hear something, it's good to be cautious rather than to ignore it. Because if it really is something dangerous, really is something bad, and we ignore it even once, that can be a very, very costly mistake. So we pay more attention to things that are threatening, to information about threats, above and beyond things that are positive, above and beyond things that are neutral, and even above and beyond things that are just negative or unpleasant.
It sort of gets us back to horror in some way, because you write that a good horror writer understands the connection here. I think they have a sense of what it is that might be embedded in our brain. For example, in the book, you talk about how we find certain characteristics from, you know, like our deep past in our folk stories, but also in our scary movies, like how Dracula has these oversized canine teeth, or how, you know, that freaky clown, you know, Pennywise in It has that huge mouth of teeth. And Freddy Krueger has a, not just a glove, but a claw glove.
Right. Yeah, those are all, you know, and the claw glove's a good example because we have kind of from the horse's mouth where that came from, right? Wes Craven in an interview said that he wanted something that would be like a primordial fear, something that, you know, anybody from any culture at any time would know to fear. And he thought, well, maybe, you know, a claw of something like a tiger would be something that everybody would fear. And so he just transposed that onto a glove. And there you go. Now you have a horror monster. And I think he's hitting on something important, which is that horror monsters do a really good job of portraying not just threat, but maybe even a specific kind of threat, in particular predators that would have hunted humans and our ancestors for millions of years. You know, the main features of terrestrial mammalian predators are large teeth, large claws. They're fast, they're sneaky, a lot like every successful horror villain.
Colton Scrivener, we're talking about his new book, Morbidly Curious: A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing whether there's something wrong with you if you're drawn to some pretty dark stuff like slasher films. Do you find it hard to look away from an accident scene or an open casket? Do you love true crime podcasts and stories about plagues and disasters? Well, the psychologist Colton Scrivener says there's nothing wrong with you. You just possess a trait that has been vital to human nature. Basically, it's an evolutionary tool that lets you experience fear and loss, but from a safe distance. Think of it as practice for the real thing. Scrivener's book is called Morbidly Curious. One of the questions you get at in the book is why it is some people are drawn to not just morbidly curious, but like the really kind of extreme stuff, the really dark stuff, the content that, you know, shows evil and suffering you know, torture. And you ask whether it's a sign. This is one of the questions. Like, is it a sign of moral bankruptcy? That is there a moral component to all of this? You know, like a lack of morals. How do you deal with just the question itself? Because it seems like those judgy film critics, there's a moral component to that. And I'm wondering how you explain and understand that question, not just the idea of whether or not it is moral bankruptcy, that people find a morality in this question.
Well, I think it's always going to be like that because by its very nature, the things that are dangerous are things that we should avoid, right? Our culture tends to have taboos about avoiding them because they're dangerous, right? And so if you show an interest in that thing, an outside person doesn't know if you're showing an interest in that thing because you're trying to learn about it and avoid it, or because you're trying to learn about it and become it. And so I think just by its very nature, morbid curiosity will always probably have a little bit of a veil around it that seems kind of dark. I hope that we'll become more aware of how it can be completely, I would say, amoral, unrelated to how moral you are or not. I think our ancestors probably understood that. I think a lot of people today, certainly in non-traditional societies, understand that. I think we live in a very safe society, safer than any humans who have ever existed for hundreds of thousands of years. And so I think we've done a really good job of protecting ourselves from things that are from the world, from the dangerous aspects of the world. And we've, I think, almost forgotten that, hey, those things do still exist. We still have this desire to understand them, but because they don't seem to be as present as they would have been historically, maybe it seems like people who are overtly interested in topics like that, maybe they have something wrong with them, right? Mm. Maybe they are like those things.
You read about that urge to kind of understand the mind of the murderer. Like there's a section about that. But before we get to sort of the modern version of this, we have psychologists and true crime documentaries and all of those kinds of things. Would you say a little bit about the history of morbid curiosity? I mean, this thing is not modern. We've been thinking about this for a long time.
Yeah, like I mentioned, Aristotle thought about it in the form of like tragedies, for example. I think it was David Hume, right, who said something that it was along the lines of it's interesting and unaccountable curiosity that people take pleasure in tragedies. And I give this story in the book about it was from Plato about a guy named Leontius, a man named Leontius, who was walking along the city walls and he looks out over the walls and he sees this pile of bodies from the city's executioner. And he initially shields himself from it. And then he gets this urge to just run to the edge of the wall so that he can get a better look. And Plato writes about this. He says that Leontius threw open his eyes and sort of cursed his own eyes for wanting to look at this. And Plato uses that as a way to talk about sort of the battle between reason and emotions. My own inclination is that, reason and emotions are not so separate. But he uses it as an example of that. But I think it's a great example of the mixed emotional nature of morbid curiosity, where you don't always want to be exposed to something, but there is an urge to kind of want to know about it or learn about it. And that's exactly what Leontius was doing. And so Plato called that, rationality versus emotions. But I would just argue that there is a rationality to emotions, right? There is a rationality to curiosity. There is a rationality to disgust and fear and all these things. But what he was really experiencing was just was morbid curiosity. It was a mixed emotional experience.
Of course, the modern interest in true crime really kind of takes off when this kind of new reality emerges. The serial killer, Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy, write about, and they really sort of solidified in popular culture, and we became kind of obsessed about like what's going on in their minds. So I guess maybe we should get that sort of obvious question out of the way. The serial killers, the psychopaths, are they more drawn to horror movies or violent video games than the general population?
there's not a lot of good data on that question in general. There's a little bit of data on, like, I think I give the example in chapter 12 about school shooters, and that school shooters who are overwhelmingly male are less likely to be interested in violent video games than the average, like, teenage boy, for example. And I don't think that's because, you know, playing violent video games makes you less likely to be a school shooter either. It's just that it probably has very little to do with actual violence. But yeah, there's not much, I would say, quantitative evidence for whether or not, like, a psychopath or a serial killer is more interested in horror. I would say that, you know, like Dahmer, he was famous for really enjoying The Exorcist 3 and kind of making his victims watch it, and even said himself that he was morbidly curious.
Right.
I think to the extent that, let's say, serial killers are more, if they are more interested in, or are interested at all in sort of macabre entertainment, I think they're interested in it for obviously a different reason than the average person is interested in it, right? I mean, just because someone is interested in something doesn't mean they're interested in it for the same reason that you are, or because, you know, if they commit a behavior, if they engage in some behavior, they might do it for a different reason than you engage in that behavior. And so I think we have to be careful not to kind of conflate those things. But, you know, a serial killer, sure, if they're interested in violent media, maybe it's because they take pleasure in that, right? But that doesn't mean that everyone who is interested in violent media takes pleasure in the suffering itself. They could take pleasure in other aspects of the story, for example, learning about the dangers and even seeing retribution in the films.
What is it about violence that is so alluring? I mean, you mentioned in the book that you spent a lot of time thinking about this early on as a scientist.
Yeah.
Because you were as you say in the book, you were intrigued that violence is largely considered wrong, which that seems intriguing. Well, of course it's considered wrong, but get at what you were interested in about that. Like, what is it about the threat of violence and that part of violence that interests you?
Yeah, I mean, I was, as we kind of mentioned at the beginning of our discussion here, that was the first thing that I started looking into, was how can we have this thing that seems so universally taboo in some ways? How do we have it also as a form of entertainment, and how does it get become socially sanctioned in some ways, and why? If it's a thing that we should avoid, why do we have situations where we don't want to avoid it, and we'll even pay money to not avoid it, right? And I think, you know, all of the different types of morbid curiosity come down to violence, right? It's all about avoiding something that can harm you, right? So violence is always at the core, but that's just one way of learning about violence is to witness violence, right? But that is only one way to learn about it. You could also learn about something that's dangerous or could cause violence by studying the aftermath of it. So the bodily injuries, for example. You could learn about violence and how to avoid it by studying the people who commit violence and learning about people who are dangerous. So true crime, for example. So there's a lot of ways to be morbidly curious or learn about potential threats, but they do ultimately all, I think, come down to this compulsion to avoid being a victim of some sort of violent threat or violent accident.
You talk about one of the ways humans sort of process the idea of threat, this threat of violence, is, you know, through games and play. And so there are these themes that apply about violent movies, for example, and games. That is that they have to have a truth value. They have to have a real world relevance. They have to have actual moral implications. And I guess what you're getting at here is that if we're going to learn from them, of course they have to be gory, or they have to be terrifying, or there has to be something at stake. That's how we learn, I guess, right?
Yeah, and that's how the situation would present itself maybe in the real world, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the obvious counter to that is, what about, like, you know, slapstick violence and, you know, horror comedies, for example. And, you know, those could serve a different purpose. It's not the case. I'm not making the claim that every time we witness something violent, we're learning something, right? But what I am making the claim about is that violence is something that historically, evolutionarily, is important, not just for humans, but any animal to learn about. And so when there is an act of violence or potential for violence somewhere in a story, it is going to draw our attention, whether or not we're truly learning something from it. Hmm.
Do you draw a distinction between a Tarantino movie or a Game of Thrones episode and a snuff film or a video of an ISIS beheading? Because there are a lot of websites out there that show real gore, you know, car crashes and industrial accidents. So how are you processing the distinctions that might be there?
Well, I think the core motivational systems are the same. What differs is, of course, some of those moderating factors. If you're witnessing an act of what you know to be real violence, it affects you differently as far as activating your empathy or your disgust or your anger. It affects you differently emotionally than watching what you know to be a fictional act of violence. It's more difficult to watch. It's more difficult to watch more of them, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really those moderating factors that are distinguishing those things. You know, we probably take more positive affect or pleasure in fictional acts of violence than we would a real act of violence for that reason.
Why do you think it is that humans, this has seemed like a question you really got at in some of your work. Why is it that humans could really be really gruesomely violent in the past? And this is something you write about. Like, here's some of the questions you ask. And I'm thinking about, you know, executions in the medieval days or whatever. You say, why gut someone and pull their intestines out of their body? Why behead them and put their heads on a spike? Like, what's going on there? How do you understand the really gruesome, violent stuff?
What seems to be the case is that we are often gruesomely violent to send a message. But the message we're sending is, seems to be, one part of it seems to be that we are more powerful than you imagined us to be. And you might ask, well, like, how does that make you more powerful, right? How does that, being gruesomely violent, that make you more terrible or more, you know, like, I'm less likely to want to meet you or something, but how would it make you more powerful? Well, in the study we did, people envisioned perpetrators of gruesome. So we asked people, like, how big do you think this person is? How tall, strong, likely to want to fight? And when they were envisioning someone who was described as committing an act of gruesome violence, they envisioned them as much larger and stronger than when they envisioned people who had killed someone, but not in a gruesome fashion. And what's probably going on there is that bodily injuries are a pretty good indication of how strong the danger, the threat was. So if I fall off of a 10-foot ledge, I'm going to get an injury, and that injury probably looks like I fell off a 10-foot ledge. If I fall off a 100-foot ledge, I'm going to get a different kind of injury, and it's going to look more like I fell off a 100-foot ledge, right? It indexes how bad the thing was. If a 40-pound beast attacks me in the woods, I'm going to have some injuries associated with that. If a 400-pound beast attacks me in the woods, I will have a different set of injuries that are more severe. Probably I will be dead. But those injuries will kind of track how large and how strong, how powerful, how bad the thing was. And so when we see gruesome violence, it kind of in our mind maps onto, oh, wow, this injury is really severe. Something really powerful must have done this. And so you can kind of, it's almost like a trick, you know, of the mind. You can kind of trick people into imagining or envisioning or just sort of intuitively believing that you are stronger than you really are.
Colton Scrivener, his new book is called Morbidly Curious: A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the psychologist Colton Scrivener. We're talking about his new book, Morbidly Curious. Our morbid curiosity about dead bodies is so interesting, and there's so many questions in the book that you raise about our reactions to dead bodies, like how we react to them, why we're drawn to them, like why some species carry around dead bodies. And I mean, there's a lot here, but what is it that you think you now understand that you might not have about? Like, what was the most interesting part of this area for you, do you think?
Yeah, I guess, you know, when it came to the research I was doing on our interest in injuries and dead bodies, I came across a line of research on funerary practices that I thought was super interesting. And a lot of this was done by a researcher named Claire White. She has done a lot of interesting work, along with Dan Fessler. He's done some of this too, showing that bodily injuries are really good cues of death, right? And we just talked about that, right? Like the more severe the danger was, the more severe the bodily injuries are. Well, also, you know, the more likely you are to be dead if you have bodily injuries, like right. Severe bodily injuries. And I think one of the most interesting things to come out of that for me was this realization that in the U.S. in particular, practices we have around funerals where we dress up the body, put makeup on it, but we don't do it, pay someone else to do it. So it's like we see our loved one on her deathbed, maybe the day, let's say the day before they pass.
Yeah.
The body goes to the funeral home, the body gets dressed up, gets made up, looks sort of alive. And that might actually be doing us a disservice, right? That might actually make it more difficult psychologically for us to move on through the grief process because we are not getting these clear signs that this social partner is no longer able to be a social partner.
You write this in the book that the disgust you feel toward a corpse isn't just saying don't eat it. It might be about empathy.
There's two things going on there. It's like with the dead corpse, I think I make the point that we have this disgust response
yeah.
towards dead bodies, right? And we think about that as like, oh, don't touch this. It could be infectious. It could have something nasty,
sure.
you know. Again, think about it from like a smoke detector principle point of view. It's not a terrible approach. But a lot of dead bodies really aren't that infectious. They can be. They can be. But really, probably what your disgust system is telling you is don't eat that. You know, whether it's a human or another animal or whatever, like if it's sitting on the side of the road rotting, like don't. What your disgust system is telling you is do not put that in your mouth. Like don't ingest it, because if you ingest it, you are a lot more likely to get something that is infectious than if you just touch it, right? And I think with the injury thing, what's going on, interesting set of studies where this researcher, Tom Kupfer, he showed that what people call disgusting sometimes might actually be just a form of empathy, like empathic pain,
right?
Feeling bad for another person because they're in pain. And in English, we don't really have a good word for that. And so, you know, disgust is the closest phenomenologically. It's the closest thing we feel. And it's associated with something that can be disgusting. An injury can be disgusting. And when I say disgusting, I mean, again, the evolutionary function of disgust is to prevent you from engaging with something that could lead to infection or sickness. Typically, that means not eating it, but it could mean not touching it, right? This is why, like, infectious, dermatologically infectious things look really gross to us, like rashes on the skin or cuts or bleeds. Or, you know, those are clear signs that so there's some kind of often that there's some kind of infection. But of course, you can have a cut or a other kind of thing that kind of looks like it would be caused by an infection, but may not actually have been caused by that. And so that may be why we feel disgust towards injuries, even if they are not infectious. And what Tom Kupfer showed was that if you made it really clear to people whether or not an injury was caused by an infection, they distinguished it, right? And so, like, he gives a pretty clear example where he ran this experiment where he had, like, bandages that were presumably or ostensibly from different kinds of injuries. So they were bandages that were used to dress them. And in one example, he had, you know, bandage from, I think it was like a fish hook that someone had in their eye, right? And this was the patch they had on their eye. And then in another example, it was, I think, like an infection in the eye. And he said, you know, you got to touch one of these with gloves on. Which one are you going to touch? And the participants overwhelmingly, of course, chose the fish hook one, not because it was less painful or because whatever. It was because they knew that, you know, it's less likely to be an infectious thing. That's just an injury. But they still described it as disgusting. But they made clear behavioral choices consistent with avoiding the infection. And so his whole point, and he did some other interesting studies in that set about showing that it may actually be something closer to empathy in any of these cases. But all that to say that the disgust response, much like the smoke detector is wired to be probably a little bit sensitive, because a cut on your skin could be because of an infection, especially historically. But it could just be that you cut your arm on a branch or a rock or whatever, you fell. And I think we're wired to kind of be a little curious about that, because if we're going to help someone, we need to know, like, can we touch this? Can we address this? Does it need a certain kind of medicine? You know, curiosity about bodily injuries. If we didn't have that, we never would have developed medicine. We wouldn't have developed an interest in even treating those kinds of things. We would have just avoided them. So I think the curiosity aspect is really important in ways that we don't normally think about.
You have a whole section on empathy, the idea of empathy. And you say it's one of the most common questions you get when you're talking about horror is whether or not, in fact, horror fans are just less empathetic than other people. Answer the question first, and then let's talk about it. Like, are they?
They don't seem to be.
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much too confidently, because I've only done one set of studies, right?
Yeah.
What I can say is that the studies that I've seen where it says they are less empathetic have a lot of flaws methodologically. So we talked about those earlier, like, for example, saying that people who enjoy watching a kill scene with no context, of course, those people probably score a little lower in empathy. But mm-hmm. the question is, are those people morbidly curious or horror fans, or are they just sadistic, right? So it's just a poor measurement. It's a measurement issue more than anything. And in the studies where I think the measurement issues have been less problematic, including studies that I've done myself, you don't see any difference between horror. So, for example, people who've seen more horror movies or who call themselves more of a horror fan, they don't score lower on measures of affective empathy or cognitive empathy, or higher in measures of things like cold-heartedness, right? These callous traits. In fact, they score a bit lower on averaging in these callous traits.
Yeah, you tested the stereotype.
Yeah. Well, I tested it a couple of ways. I mean, I tested it first to see if it was really a stereotype, right? It seemed like one.
Yeah.
But I gave people, you know, these profiles, fictional profiles that they thought were real, and said, you know, if you correctly guess this person's traits, you'll get a bonus on your for participating in the study. And of course, they were all made up individuals anyway, and so everybody got the bonus. But I basically just gave like a name, an age, and a favorite movie genre. And then I asked people, okay, well, how extroverted do you think this person is? How introverted? How agreeable? How empathetic? How unkind or kind, you know? And people had an intuition that people that profiles of people who like horror movies, they rated them as less kind, less empathetic,
right.
And sometimes even said that was why they rated them that way. And so then once I had that, I was like, okay, this seems empirically like something that people really believe, right? And then I tested it, you know, to see if people who did like horror movies or who watched more horror movies, if they behaved that way, and if they're psychometrically, if their measurements of their empathy were that way, and it wasn't. In most cases, there was just no difference. And where there was a difference, it was in a direction such that they were a little bit more empathetic or caring.
Is it fair to say you have a kind of, I wouldn't say controversial, but a complicated way of explaining how you see empathy? You know, the question of whether or not empathy is always good, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Paul Bloom probably, he's the lightning rod for that, because he wrote a book called Against Empathy, right?
Right, right.
So
right.
I think he introduced people to the idea and took maybe a lot of the flack. I don't know. I haven't heard too much pushback on my end, but partly because he presented this idea really well, that empathy is not always the virtuous trait that we think it is, right? That doesn't mean it's always bad either. It just means that it's not this like moral North Star that we think it is. And his basic argument is that empathy is very parochial. So you tend to be empathetic for people who you're close to and less empathetic for people you're not close to, which good adaptively, but maybe a poor moral guide as far as living in a world where there are a lot of strangers around you. And he argues instead that we should have compassion for people, so sort of rational compassion. And interestingly, rational compassion, so like low cold-heartedness, that's where horror fans scored better.
One of the big questions that comes up in the book, and there's this section on kids, and the question is, you know, if you're a parent, should you let your kid watch scary movies? And you really dig into the question of how much risk we're tolerating for kids, how much independence we give them these days. But back up and talk a little bit about, like, there's this study, for example, you mentioned that was done in Danish schools where researchers were trying to understand just how scary play worked with kids. Will you talk a little bit about that? How do kids process, like, you know, scary stuff?
Yeah, well, kids play all sorts of scary games without input from adults, right? If you let kids engage in pretend play and you don't direct it, it's undirected play, usually they'll come up with some kind of pretend scenario where there's a good guy and a bad guy, and the bad guy is usually really bad. And, you know, in this study of Danish preschools and the teachers, they found that the kids had this just incredible hunger for this pretty morbid game, this game called Werewolf, where there's usually like two bad people, two werewolves, and then the rest of the people are citizens, and you kind of have to figure out who the werewolves are, right? Mm. And the werewolves are killing people in the town and eating them. And anyway, they found out that, you know, these kids who were 4, 5, 6 years old just like begged to play this game. And the school teachers actually thought this kind of thing and other types of scary play, like reading scary stories to them, was actually good for them. They had this intuition that engaging with scary things in a playful way is good for kids and can help them learn how to deal with fear and anxiety. And that's really the argument that I make and have some empirical evidence for, is that engaging with things that are scary can be good for kids because it helps them develop emotion regulation skills for dealing with fear and anxiety.
So if you think about it, like, just in an evolutionary way, basically what's going on with kids is they're practicing feeling afraid.
Yeah, they're practicing to be adults, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes literally and sometimes figuratively, and sometimes they're practicing actual things they may do. Maybe they play with a bow, like in a traditional society, maybe they have a toy bow and arrow, and other times it may be more figuratively or symbolically, and they're engaging in scary play where they feel afraid and they're just learning how to regulate feelings of fear and feelings of anxiety and operate well under those situations.
So should parents let their kids watch scary movies if they, I mean...
If they want to, I think so. Yeah. I think that, you know, I do think that there are movies that are going to be better for kids and worse for kids as far as how violent they are, how much they are. And it's not even because I think kids should be necessarily just prevented from seeing certain kinds of violence or whatever. But, you know, when you're a kid, everything seems novel and new to you. And so if you show someone something that is just blows their worldview too much, I mean, that can be lead to nightmares and other kinds of things. But if a kid wants to watch something or read something or do something that seems a little scary, I think it's perfectly good and normal and healthy for you to let them do it, especially if you do it with them. Kind of show them that, yeah, this is scary, but we can get through it, or it's just a story, or here's how you can become, you know, more brave when you're experiencing this. So I think it's a teaching opportunity, a learning opportunity.
One of the things you write about in the book is how we harness the beast, is how you put it, harness this curiosity for good to sort of, you know, live better lives, overcome some of the fears we have. What do you recommend in that sense? What do you have in mind there?
I think just, a simpler way of saying it would be just make yourself uncomfortable every now and then. That's how you learn, right? You kind of learn when you're at the edge of your comfort, the edge of your skill, the edge of what you can handle. That's when you challenge yourself. It's when you feel emotions that you typically avoid, like fear and anxiety. And it's when you can get better at sort of approaching the unknown, approaching things that are uncertain, and feeling more confident in your ability to do so.
Let me ask you finally, it was something you say early on is you hope with the book that people will find some insights about themselves. What do you think reading this or understanding, you know, why it is they're morbidly curious, what do you think that will do if someone comes to a deeper insight about themselves?
Well, it depends who they are. You know, if you're a morbidly curious person reading it, maybe you feel a little better about yourself, because a lot of people do feel conflicted about their morbid curiosity, right? They're like Leontius running to look at the bodies, you know? You feel a certain kind of way about it. And I think having an answer to why not just you, but many other people feel that way can be comforting. And I think for people who don't have that inclination, which not everyone does, but certainly everyone knows someone who does, you can, I think, understand a little better why other people might be that way, and it'll help prevent those gut reactions like we saw from Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert about people who do enjoy it, even when you don't.
Colton Scribner. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colton Scribner, he's a psychologist at Arizona State University. His new book is Morbidly Curious: A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. By the way, you can go to Scribner's website and take his morbid curiosity test there. Now, here's the first question to get you thinking. On a scale from strongly disagree to strongly agree, if a head transplant was possible, I would want to watch the procedure. That's at ColtonScribner.com. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.